This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, if you've got a child in school or are an educator yourself, you've been hearing all about the Common Core standards. This could mean a big change in the way teachers teach and kids learn. We'll find out more later in our show. But first, last week we saw some shocking data from the State Department of Education showing that almost 1,000 children age 6 or younger were suspended from Connecticut schools last year. Suspension has long been used by schools as a way to isolate disruptive children. Sometimes these kids aren't just disrupting the learning process, they're also acting violently. But are schools too quick to remove kids for their behavior? These data also show that a disproportionate number of suspended students are Black and Hispanic and living in low-income districts with high rates of poverty and unemployment. Today, Where We Live, we'll try to find out if there's a better way to meet the needs of all students without taking some of them out of school. Joining us today is Dr. Walter Gilliam. He's associate professor at the Child Study Center at Yale. He's director of the Ziegler Center in Child Development and Social Policy. He joins us from the Yale studios in New Haven today. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also want to welcome in Jamie Bell, who is the child advocate for the state of Connecticut. Welcome back to our program, Jamie.
Thank you, John.
And Diane Orson is with us. She's our education reporter and senior editor. Hi, Diane.
Hi, John.
We also want to hear from you. Do you have a kindergarten child who's been suspended from school? How else can we deal with very young students who disrupt the learning environment for others? Call us, please, at 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can also email us at wherewelive@wnpr.org or tweet us at wherewelive. Jamie Bell, so why don't you tell us about this data? What does it find?
So this data finds that actually it's 1,967 children.
A few more than 1,000.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Children ages 6 and under who were suspended from school during the 11-12 school year. So not this current school year, but last school year. And it breaks it down by children who were in school suspended and then children who were suspended out of school. And it shows, you know, almost 2,000 kids is a shocking number of very young children who were removed from their learning environment at that very young age.
Should we be shocked by this? Is this something that's been going on forever? We just weren't paying attention?
Well, I think we should be shocked by it because we need to look at what the consequences are for these kids and whether or not there is a better way to deal with children this young who, for some reason or another, have dysregulated behavior that is a challenge for educators to teach them. And I know that that's what Dr. Gilliam is an expert in and is going to talk about. In terms of whether it's new, I don't believe it's new. I think that the numbers overall across the state with all children's ages are going down. But nonetheless, it's still a large problem. And since these children are so young and their brains are pliable and flexible and they're still developing, there is a better way to deal with these children's disruptive behaviors than removing them from the learning environment when they really need to be there because this is such a critical age.
Before we get to Dr. Gilliam, I want to talk a bit about the policies that might lead to this. Obviously, we have a very strong local control form of education here in the state, so every single town, it seems, has their own school district, their own way of dealing with things. Is there state guidance on this? Is there any sort of overarching policy about how you'd suspend someone, especially in kindergarten?
There is state policy that was made into law a couple of years ago, and it shifted the paradigm from leaping to out-of-school suspensions for all age children to having a preference and a default position being in-school suspensions. And that's real progress because out-of-school suspensions are obviously more exclusive and children are tend to be more disengaged if they're out of school suspended. But in-school suspensions also have criteria that have to be met for both kinds. And essentially, one thing that's really important for this age population is that the law requires that school districts look at, before they suspend out of school, they look at efforts by the administration to address such disciplinary problems through means other than out of school suspension and expulsion, including positive behavioral support strategies. So that's really key here because, you know, all kids respond better to positive interventions. But little kids, particularly, who may not have the cognitive and developmental ability to even understand what their behavior was about and to control it, are going to respond much more positively and much more adaptively and healthily to positive interventions rather than a negative consequence, such as being removed from school, which they might not, or they're unlikely to understand.
Dr. Gilliam, what can you tell us about this?
Well, it depends on what you want to know about it. We've known about the problem of suspensions and expulsions in public schools for a long time, but there was a report that I conducted back in 2005 that showed that the rate of expulsions and suspensions is even higher when you're talking about preschool age children or children in child care programs. So this is certainly not something that begins even in kindergarten or first grade. This is something that for many kids begins from the very first time that they ever step into a group educational setting, maybe as young as three years old or infants and toddlers.
But what can be done to help teachers who are overwhelmed by disruptive kids?
Well, one of the things that Connecticut has that's been very successful in recent years is a program called the Early Childhood Consultation Partnership Program. It's a program for providers in child care programs and preschool programs statewide, public or private. Every square inch of Connecticut is covered, where a provider or a teacher is concerned about the behavior of a child and thinks that child might be at imminent risk of being expelled or suspension. They can request a consultant to come in. The behavioral consultant comes in, works with the teacher, develops some positive strategies regarding that individual child's behavior, but also, in many cases, it's largely about classroom management on the whole, how this teacher can be a more effective classroom director. And as a result of that, behavior problems dramatically decrease in a very, very short period of time. One of the things that I like about this program is it's extremely cheap, and certainly a whole lot cheaper than any alternative that we have. But in addition to consultation models, there's the positive behavioral supports that Jamie was talking about. There's social-emotional curricula that exists where teachers can actually teach children social-emotional skills in the classroom setting. Many of these things have existed for quite some time. The problem is that although a few schools implement these things, many schools do not. And as a result, they just simply rely on expulsions and suspensions practices as if that was some kind of an intervention.
Can you talk about the effect on children who are expelled or suspended?
Certainly. One of the things that we certainly know is that the best predictor of a child being expelled or suspended is that child having been expelled or suspended before. And so one of the things that we can certainly say is that if the purpose of expelling a child or suspending a child is to actually correct the behavior, it certainly doesn't seem to be working. In many cases, children are expelled or suspended multiple times. And so if it's an intervention and the design is to actually be of some benefit to children, it doesn't seem to be doing that. For really young children, it's not even clear that after a day of being excluded from the classroom, they even have any idea why they're not there anymore. And so the whole idea of this being some kind of a corrective to their behavior doesn't really seem to make much sense. The other thing that it does is it removes the child from the classroom learning environment. In many cases, these children are already behind educationally, and that may be what's giving rise to the behavior problems in the classroom. To make them further behind certainly doesn't make much sense.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk about the shocking numbers of suspensions for kids in kindergarten, even younger than that in Connecticut. You can also email us where we live at WNPR.org. But Meg is on the line from Guilford. Hi there, Meg. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Great. Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Such a great and important show. I've been calling because I actually have a daughter in kindergarten myself, and I am an educator, and I really appreciate what your guests have already said about, you know, steps between a behavior issue and a suspension. And I think one of the things that I really noticed is, and I don't think any of my kids' friends have gotten suspended, but the model of, you know, external reward and consequence-based behavior stuff doesn't always take into account the social and emotional learning that your guests have discussed. And it's great to have that kind of a curriculum, but even in places where there is a curriculum in place, sorry, my daughter is in the background trying to get on the radio here. if the teacher isn't fully implementing a social and emotional curriculum for all kids, it seems like that really key piece falls through the cracks.
Well, and as an educator, and I know that you've got your daughter back there vying for your attention, but I should ask you, Meg, this idea that teachers would even have the time to be able to deal with some of these social emotional issues.
That's the big problem. If it's seen as just, you know, I can't do that right now. You can say something in a minute. Sorry about that, everyone. If it's seen as just one more standard, just one more requirement that needs to be implemented. So, sorry, everyone. if it's seen as one more requirement that just needs to be added to the schedule, then, yeah, I think people are going to rebel. But something like mindfulness in the classroom, if teachers are taught these tools and, you know, can take just the time of one regular teacher in service to learn some really key tools for kids to get in touch with their own feelings and delay their reaction time, then those are things that can be implemented during regular classroom activities. They don't take any extra time. It's not an extra lesson. It's just a different approach and a way of talking about behavior so that a negative behavior isn't seen just as, you know, a standalone thing, and we don't just treat the symptoms. We look at some of the feelings behind it.
Well, Meg, thank you so much, and I really appreciate you calling with everything else going on. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Hey, no, that's okay. We understand people for vying for your time. Jamie Bell, you wanted to comment?
I just wanted to say that in terms of resources, because it's a really important issue, because school districts have, as that caller mentioned, a lot of requirements and mandates, as sometimes they interpret them as. But I wanted to just say that my office feels firmly that the Department of Education, the State Department of Education, has this issue on its radar screen, and it is trying to be serve as, you know, as a leader in this area and provide resources and offer resources to school districts who want to try to do better within their school districts. And I was meeting with the commissioner yesterday on another matter, but an issue related to this came up. And it's really clear that through the State Education Resource Center, there is help that school districts can ask for and receive in terms of changing the climate and the overall approach and the values that educators and the school district brings to their school district. So I hope that that school districts will see it as a resource and view it as something that they're not standing alone on, and that there is a lot of help out there because there are a lot of people concerned about it.
And does that include help for social workers and mental health workers in the school's guidance counselors' support for teachers?
Well, I think that that's optimally what they would like to be able to provide. I think resources and budget and funding is always an issue. But I just encourage, and as an advocate, I want to make sure that everyone understands that asking for things and pushing for things, even if they're not available right now, is a good way to raise awareness of the issue and increase the kinds of resources that might be available. If it's known and people realize it and have it as a value, then the resources can sometimes follow.
And Dr. Gilliam, I know that this is something that you work on, using these resources differently that are in a school already. Sometimes you can ask for more resources, but sometimes the people who are working there already can help to solve the problem.
Absolutely. Many of these elementary schools, they have school psychologists on staff, they have guidance counselors on staff, social workers on staff. This is reminding me of a case about, I'm thinking maybe about 6 or 7 years ago. It was in Tampa, Florida. Kindergarten age child, kindergarten in Tampa, Florida, who was having a temper tantrum in the classroom. The teacher removed all the children from the classroom. This happened to be actually videotaped at the time because of some teacher training that was happening. And all the children were evacuated from the classroom because of this child's relatively mild temper tantrum. Eventually, the child was moved to the assistant principal's office. They contacted the state police, brought in the police department. The police came in there in the classroom, handcuffed a 5-year-old kindergarten child. Handcuffs didn't fit on the child's hands, so they tied the child's hands behind the back, put the handcuffs on the ankles, carried the child out to the police car, booked the child, arraigned the child in the police department, and held the child there until the parents came to pick her up. And then they contacted me, the newspaper there did, for some comments on it. And the first question that I had was, well, where were the school psychologists? Where were the guidance counselors? Where were the social workers? And apparently, over time, what seemed to be the case was no one thought of it as a social, emotional, or as a mental health, or as an educational issue. They thought of it as a criminal issue, and so they treated it that way.
But this idea of what's a criminal issue, what's a social and behavioral issue, what's an educational issue, in the rest of our program, after we move on from this conversation in just a bit, we're going to be talking about the Common Core Standards, and there's so much that people are talking about, Dr. Gilliam, around educating our kids, and it seems as though the social, emotional, behavioral piece that's so important, especially at the kindergarten level, it doesn't seem to be part of a lot of people's educational mindset. How do we change that?
Well, that's a sad reality that you just mentioned there, John. There's been numerous studies of surveying employers about the types of things and the types of skills that they value when they're thinking about hiring a person, when they're thinking about promoting a person, retaining a person. And typically on those surveys, the very top skills that they're looking for are the things that we refer to as soft skills, the ability to get along with other people, the ability to be able to think creatively, the ability to be able to be respectful to others, to be able to work within an organization. These are the types of things that we really should be targeting and thinking more about in terms of our early childhood care and education programs, because as a former public school teacher myself, I couldn't agree with Meg and her daughter more when she was talking about the fact that teachers are going to have to deal with this anyway, one way or another. You can either deal with it effectively at the front end of the problem, or we can choose to deal with it very ineffectively at the back end of the problem. But either way, you're going to deal with it. It's kind of like having a car. You either change your oil when you should, or you change your oil when your car engine locks up. So I think it's much better to be able to think about these things proactively and think about ways in which we can actually teach children the social-emotional skills necessary to be successful in a school environment. We talk about school readiness all the time in Connecticut. School readiness is not just about ABCs and 1-2-3s. It's about the ability to know how to effectively organize yourself in a classroom learning environment. And those are the types of skills that we should also be focusing on very seriously.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Catherine's in Milford. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Catherine Meyer. I'm an attorney at the Center for Children's Advocacy. And I actually was quoted in the recent Hartford Current article because, unfortunately, I have a fair number of clients who are these children. So I have, like I said in the article, I have more than a handful every year. I work mostly in Bridgeport and Fairfield County. And my clients are low-income children of color, and many of them have unidentified special education needs, mental health needs. Some of them have developmental delays, things like that. And they are the kids that we're talking about. One comment I would like to add, which is kind of being the bearer of bad news to even worse news, is that I really see this problem as being incredibly underreported. I have a fair number of parent clients who are called multiple times a week, 4 and 5 days a week, you know, every day sometimes, and they're asked to pick up their child early. And the schools are not recording this as a suspension. I have some schools that even set up arranged schedules that a child is picked up early every single day, and, you know, they say the kid can't handle the afternoon or after lunch needs to go home or something like that. And I have parents who lose their jobs because the schools place these expectations on them. So it's a huge problem. One more thing I'll add is that I had a client a few years ago, a five-year-old client in the kindergarten classroom, and the kindergarten teacher called the police to come deal with this child. So this is happening right here in our state. You know, it didn't make the news, and thankfully he wasn't handcuffed. And when the police officer came, he was able to defuse the situation. But he should have never been called in the first place.
My goodness. And we were all shocked by that story that the doctor was just telling, and it's happening here in Connecticut. Catherine, first of all, thank you very much for that. And I think Diane Orson and I are looking at each other. We want to follow up on these statistics, which I think is very important.
Just one more thing I wanted to comment. One of the things that was striking about the statistics was the disparity town to town, city to city, and even school to school, which to me sends a message of also leadership and policy. That the message that's coming across to educators.
And we saw a huge number, for instance, the Achievement First Hartford Schools, a charter school that's shown some success in the educational field, a very high number of suspensions in that school. Some districts handle things quite a bit differently than others. The Connecticut Mirror has a thorough story with a graph of all these numbers if you want to take a closer look at ctmirror.org. Let's quickly go to a few more phone calls. Bill's in Madison. We just have a few moments left. Bill, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, hi. First, I just want to say thank you to your guests who show extraordinary patience and care and the necessary emotional detachment to be effective in making a change in this problem. I consider this problem so outrageous that I'm not sure I could do their job, which is to straighten this out. It just does not make us feel at all confident in the system as it is. This just should not be happening. It's an outrage. And if we're always saying, you know, well, what do we do about all the poor people who stay poor? Well, gee, I wonder why, when this is what you do to the kids.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for your comment. I just want to ask Jamie Bell very quickly. I mean, do you see this as some sort of a systemic problem that happens, like many things happen, in low-income neighborhoods, that happen in schools that tend to be populated by poor kids? Is your office looking at this as essentially as a systemic problem that the state needs to truly address in this way that I think Bill's suggesting?
I think it is a systemic problem that our office and a lot of other advocates are looking at and trying to address in a systemic way. But I don't think that it is just an urban problem and that it is just a problem of poor children of color. I think that the data shows that it's across the state and in other districts as well. But also, I do want to say that, and I also think that it is, I want to just strike a slightly more hopeful note, because there are signs of progress in school districts that have committed to changing the culture overall across their districts and within certain schools. And those are, you can read a lot about those on the State Department of Education website. If you go to their positive behavioral intervention and supports pages, there are reports about it. The Connecticut Voices for Children report of a couple of years ago called Teaching Discipline is a very extensive report on the positive alternatives to suspension that a lot of school districts are doing, and it's a toolkit for educators to use. I also just wanted to put in a plug for the hopefulness of setting up an Office of Early Childhood, which, as Dr. Gilliam pointed out, because this is an issue that needs to be addressed at age 1 and 2 and 3, and it's social and emotional learning. It's just as important as learning to read, and the earlier we start, earlier we start with coordinated efforts, which the Office of Early Childhood is devoted to, the better the results will be.
I want to go quickly to Lori in New Haven. A last word here, Lori. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Yes. I just wanted to comment. I have worked with children in the schools in New Haven, and I find that often what you have is a difficulty within the family to know what is available to them as far as services. You're dealing with a lot of families with financial stress, and of course the children feel that stress, and maybe they haven't been exposed to as many things as a more advantaged child would be exposed to before school, and they are not ready for the high academic expectations of school. And what they really need is an environment where they can feel secure and cared for. And oftentimes there's such a rush to get the kids ready for a test that, they're not building those social and cultural skills that they need. Well, also, sometimes the families don't know things like that libraries are free. So there's a lot of information that could be better disseminated to families, a lot of services we could be offering to families now as opposed to waiting until the kids are in high school.
And Dr. Gilliam, I'll give you the last word on this. This support for families seems so crucial in this because, as Jamie Bell was just saying, this allows people to do a better job before the kids are even getting to kindergarten.
Absolutely. And as Jamie said, I'm very hopeful also about this Office of Early Childhood. I think the potential to be able to have one centralized office to be able to pull together all the resources of the State Department of Education, Department of Social Services, Department of Children and Families, towards helping children be able to get the best start in life as possible, I think would be wonderful. That program that I mentioned before, Early Childhood Consultation Partnerships, a program that puts mental health professionals in childcare programs, is actually not ran out of the Department of Education, nor is it ran or funded out of the Department of Social Services, where many of these programs are located. It's ran out of the Department of Children and Families. And what's interesting about that to me is the fact that government actually can get this right from time to time, that there's tons of opportunities in which we can have programs that are of support and use in one department that are actually benefiting the child care programs and the educational programs that are in a different department. And so this program, that Jamie was talking about, this Office of Child Development, Early Childhood Development, I think would be a wonderful way to be able to help further pull all those resources together to make it more beneficial and available to families.
Dr. Walter Gilliam is an associate professor at the Child Study Center at Yale University, an associate professor of psychology, and he's also director of the Edward Ziegler Center in Child Development and Social Policy. He joined us today from New Haven's Yale studios. Thank you so much, Doctor.
It's my pleasure, John. Thank you.
Thanks also to Jamie Bell, the State of Connecticut Child Advocate. Thank you, Jamie. Good to see you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Diane.
We're going to continue this education conversation with Diane Orson here on WNPR. I move to the Common Core Standards, what you need to know about this big educational change coming up, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Connecticut schools have held students to rigorous academic standards for decades, but now we're one of 45 states preparing to launch the new Common Core Standards, a national curriculum that promises greater rigor, deeper learning, global competitiveness for American students. There is increasing pushback, though, from some states who say we're rushing too fast toward large-scale changes in curriculum, student assessment, and teacher evaluation systems that might not be backed by research. The high-stakes testing that we didn't like with No Child Left Behind, well, that seems to be here to stay. And we're further squeezing out resources that teach skills not tested, like some of the soft skills we were talking about before. So we're going to talk in this next segment about the Common Core Standards. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, especially if you're a parent or a teacher, what do you know about Common Core? What do you need to know? You can ask questions of our expert panel here. You can also email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. Joining me today is Diane Orson, WNPR's education reporter. So just give us a thumbnail sketch of what we're talking about here, Diane.
Well, let me start actually by saying what the Common Core is not. And actually, it's not a curriculum. That's kind of important to mention. It's really more a framework for expectations, what our students should know along the path toward college, high school, college readiness and career readiness. So it's not a fixed curriculum. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why it's such a tricky thing, because districts are given a very large task, and that is to figure out how to implement these basic expectations in the way that they feel best, you know, meets and tailors, is tailored to the needs of their students. So there will be changes to the way we teach reading and math, and very briefly, and we have an expert here who will explain all the details, but overall in the math area, what we're looking at are fewer topics taught more in depth, dig deep, and that we have found globally, when we look at our competitiveness globally, we find the countries who really do well in math teach fewer subjects, but their students really understand how to apply what they've learned in critical thinking. And in literacy, we'll also see some change in the kind of texts students are reading from, and we can learn more about that. So in a way, what they did was they started at the end. They started what do we feel like students should know by the time they finish high school? And they built a staircase down, and along the way, each step, each grade along the way, figured out what students should know along the path. That's sort of an overall idea of how it works.
So here to give us some more details, Dr. Diana Roberge-Wenzel, who's Chief Academic Officer of the State of Connecticut. She joins us in studio. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
So maybe you can flesh this out a bit more for us. What does Common Core mean for Connecticut schools, for Connecticut students and teachers?
Well, the Common Core State Standards are our Connecticut State Standards. Our State Board of Ed adopted the Common Core State Standards in 2010. And one of the most exciting aspects of this for our students is the staircase that was mentioned, the idea that they were planned backwards from college and career readiness. So the premise is college and career readiness for all. And a significant change for us is that for a long time we've talked about college or career and thought about them as different pathways. And what we learned, largely from input from the business community nationally and locally as well, is that the skills kids need to be successful on entry in college are, by and large, very much the same skills that they need to be successful in career. They need to be able to read highly technical material as well as rich literature, and they need to be able to apply mathematics concepts in deep and meaningful ways, in embedded ways in their careers. So they were planned backwards from that perspective.
So what are the on-the-ground changes that students and teachers, parents would expect to see come the next school year? Give us some examples of what's different.
Well, actually, the parents can see these changes already in their children's schools, and we hear great reports of the changes from the field because the change has been gradual over the past 3 years and will continue as we move forward in the coming years. So some of the changes involve how students interact with each other and with rich tasks in the classroom. For instance, in math, we do study fewer topics with more depth, which gives students the chance to really master certain math concepts before moving on. So rather than see sort of superficial touching on lots of different math topics, parents will generally see their children experiencing the same math topic for a long time and getting a chance to really work deeply with it. In literacy, they'll see that their kids are being asked to make responses to texts they read with evidence. And a lot of the text shifts parents will notice as well is a shift to about 50% of the material their children read being nonfiction. So while narrative and stories are still really important in children's lives, it's also very important that kids develop background knowledge and have the chance to develop rich vocabulary.
And Diane, this is something that you and I have talked about a little bit, this shift away in the literacy piece, because we're going to have a math expert come on in a little bit and talk about the changes to how math is taught. But this idea that we're going to have a lot of nonfiction reading, it seems to make sense in a lot of ways, but it also does present a pretty big change, and maybe not a welcome change for some people who've been teaching reading the same way for a long time.
I mean, I think the initial reaction is fear, like, is my kid not going to be able to read Charlotte's Web anymore and all the stories that I loved growing up? And those are stories that for many students are the things that kick off a lifelong love of reading and learning. That's not the case. That's not the idea. The idea is that there will continue to be plenty of fiction and engaging literature for students to read, but that this informational text reading, which we were just hearing about, will cross over not only in English classes, but even in science classes and in math classes, that students will be able to really understand complex, let's say, magazine articles or instructions for things, and be able to really respond to questions and answer them based on the text that they've learned, because those are skills that people need out in the real world.
When you say this crossover from literacy to math, explain how exactly that's going to work, because we seem to have thought about many of these subjects in isolation.
Separate, right?
And
right.
Maybe you can talk about that, Doctor.
Well, one of the movements that comes about in the Common Core is a movement away from the siloed approach to literacy and math. And really, it's a set of standards that's more inclusive of all disciplines. And while they really are only specific content standards for English language arts and math, one of the basic beliefs of the English language arts standards, for instance, is that you can't think deeply about trivial content, so that it's really rich literature at appropriate levels of text complexity and inclusive of the informational text that students need to be able to build background knowledge and to be able to learn other subjects.
And again, I just want to underscore again that this is not so prescriptive that every classroom is going to be on the same page on the same day in every school across the state. This is saying, here are the goals that we want to achieve, and you guys can figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're going to talk in just a moment about whether or not it's realistic to expect all of those schools to achieve all of those goals along this staircase as we're talking about. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, and Rob is calling us from West Hartford. Hi there, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two children in the same elementary school, and one is just starting out elementary school, and the other is finishing it up. And so one has gone through without any of the Common Core standards, and the other is experiencing the implementation of these standards. And I have to say that my impression is that the school is putting a tremendous amount of effort into doing this well, but that the experience of the teachers and I think of parents is that it's not yet ready for prime time. There's a lot of confusion from the teachers about what they should be doing. Some of the things they're being asked to do, they're not very happy about. Some of the things that have really helped my older child are not being taught anymore. Some of the tasks that my first grader is being asked to do are way over his head. Others are super basic. It just feels very much like my youngest child has now been involuntarily put in the role of a guinea pig for a curriculum. And I understand that maybe technically speaking, actually I don't understand why it's not a curriculum, but it certainly appears to be a curriculum that's being imposed on the teachers. And my sense is that it'll take years to sort out all these kinks. It'll be complaints or, you know, feedback from parents like me that'll probably result in some changes. And so for children like my youngest, you know, like it or not, he has to sort of be sort of a guinea pig.
Well, and Rob, I'm going to keep you on the line here and ask the doctor from the state here to comment on this. He says two things I think are really important. One is his experience is that this is not ready for prime time. There's confusion amongst parents, amongst students, amongst teachers, most importantly. Has that been any of your experience so far, doctor?
I think any time we're implementing a complex change, confusion is a likely result in early stages. We need to think about how we approach that change. And at the State Department of Ed, our approach is framed around four main areas. So as we work on our implementation of Common Core statewide, we're focusing on communication, coherence among key initiatives that the state's experiencing, some of them you referred to earlier. And then also working on curricular alignment, providing resources for districts, schools, and teachers that help them align their practices to the new expectations, because changing our work is always awkward at first. And then finally, capacity building, because a lot of what the caller references are issues where we need to support teachers and leaders in building their own capacity to carry out the changes that we know will benefit our children.
But I think the other point that he raises, though, is as we make all these changes, it's going to take some time. There's going to have to be everything from buy-in to mm-hmm. new types of instruction. Do we know that this thing that we're trying is going to work? Is there data that backs this up? The other point that Rob makes is he feels like his kid's a guinea pig in a big old experiment. Are we conducting an experiment on what education works right now? Or do we know with data, yes, when this is implemented, kids are going to learn better?
We have, luckily in Connecticut, we are sitting on a great amount of data that high standards do increase instruction. So in Connecticut, we've been in a standards-based environment since 1998, and our own results in Connecticut indicate that the implementation of standards at that point increased student achievement significantly over the decade that followed. Additionally, a difference between our previous iteration of standards, the 1998 Connecticut framework, and the Common Core state standards are that these standards are internationally benchmarked. So we can look to many other countries where this has worked really well for their students. So it puts our Connecticut students in a place to be competitive, not only with students applying to college and career from other states, but globally, which is now very important.
One thing quickly before we take our break, though, often when the United States compares itself to other countries that do something well, those other countries have more homogeneous populations. They have populations that are quite a bit different than our population. Do we know that in the types of urban and rural and suburban communities that the United States presents, that indeed this will work the way that it is able to work in some other countries where you don't have that type of diversity?
Well, an important thing to remember is that when we say this will work, standards by themselves won't do anything. It's the instruction that accompanies them that will make a difference for kids. So this is really about the school leaders and teachers on the ground using this set of standards as a tool to improve outcomes for kids. And I believe that our Connecticut teachers and leaders can do that.
We're talking today with Dr. Diana Roberge-Wenzel, who is the Chief Academic Officer for the State of Connecticut. Our education reporter, Diane Orson, joins us as well. And we're going to come back and take some more of your calls at 860-275-7266. We'll also be joined by a superintendent and a math specialist to talk more about what Common Core means to education in Connecticut. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, for his new book about how the news business has changed, journalist Dan Kennedy chose a case study that is very close to our heart, Paul Bass's indispensable New Haven Independent. Kennedy joins us to talk about his new book, The Wired City, Reimagining Journalism and Civic Life in the Post-Newspaper Age. I hope you can join us on Monday's Where We Live. Today, we're talking about the new Common Core state standards that public schools in Connecticut are implementing. You can call us at 860-275-7266. We're joined in studio today by Diane Orson, who's WNPR's education reporter, also Diana Roberge-Wenzel, who is Chief Academic Officer of the State of Connecticut. I want to bring in Dr. David Teitel, who's Superintendent of Fairfield Public Schools. And Doctor, first of all, thank you for joining us. What does all this mean for your school district? How is Fairfield adapting?
Well, the Common Core state standards are just one element of some very important major changes that school systems like ours are trying to implement simultaneously. So it's not just the Common Core state standards. And number one, you have to do the curriculum development that goes with that, because the standards are not a curriculum, as you've heard. That's a tremendously time-consuming task. It involves staff time, administrative time, and so forth. The second big thing is the professional development that has to go along with that. This is going to be a shift in instruction. There are, for example, in math, there are math practice standards about how math should be taught. And so we need to build the capacity of the teachers. And also there's a huge shift coming in assessment in a couple ways. One, there's new assessments that are accompanying the Common Core that are going to be going in place in 14-15. That's a huge shift for what we need to do. And what means is we need to go back and look at all the assessments that we give throughout the year to make sure they align with the new assessments. They're going to be computer-based. They're going to be a whole different animal, much more rigorous. And the results of those assessments are all of a sudden now even more high stakes than ever. I mean, if you thought the CMTs and the CAP were high stakes under No Child Left Behind, the new teacher and administrator evaluation program that we are all putting huge amounts of resources into gearing up for and having to implement under the new legislation is a whole new piece to this. So this is part of three enormous shifts in our school system and across the state that we're being asked to do, and from our perspective, with very few resources.
Well, and that's the key thing. So essentially, you're saying you're being told to do all this new stuff. You're not getting the resources to do it. And this assessment piece is very, very critical. This new teacher and administrator assessment regimen that's going into place is happening at a time when our, as our caller was just saying, and we were just acknowledging, there's so much change for educators right now. Dr. Teitel, do you think that we're able to make a proper assessment of people who are trying to do a job that is completely shifted beneath their feet?
Well, you've got three different change initiatives going on simultaneously. So I think it's hugely challenging. And I don't want to come across as saying I don't think change is necessary. I think we do need to make changes in our educational system. We have a huge achievement gap problem in this state and around the country that we need to address somehow. I just don't know that high-stakes tests on and tying those results to teachers' evaluations has any evidence behind it that that's going to solve the problem. Finland has some of the highest test scores in the world. They have no high-stakes tests. So I'm very concerned about our ability to implement this. I know the state has tried to put additional resources into the state budget to assist districts with this. I see largely a lot of that is going to go towards the Alliance districts, which are the 30 lowest-performing districts. That leaves 100 and 36 other districts out there. It is very difficult to simultaneously implement three major change initiatives while still teaching school every day.
Well,
we're trying to fix the plane while we're flying it here.
I'm wondering, can I just get a quick comment from you?
Sure, and that is why when I talked about the four C's of our Common Core implementation plan, coherence is one of those C's. And we are really aware that at the district level and at the school level, the hard, heavy lifting of this comes down on the same people in the classroom, in the schools, and at the district level. So one of the things that we've done is really integrate some of the tools that leaders will be using to evaluate teachers with the expectations that they should be seeing in terms of shifts in instruction in the Common Core. So the Common Core for Teaching, which is our teaching standards in Connecticut, has been revised to be inclusive of the Common Core so that administrators, when they're observing teachers, will be able to see the evidence of the changes we're looking for and coach teachers toward the new expectations.
Speaking of teachers, I want to bring in Michelle Peterson, who's a math specialist in the Farmington Public Schools. And Michelle, thank you for joining us. Maybe you can talk about what all these changes mean for teaching math. We glossed over this a little bit before, but I think it's some important changes in the math world.
You're right. Good morning. Well, there's a domino effect at the schools. So much more work comes out of this than what we've already talked about. For instance, this affects our report cards. Those have to be changed. That affects our data systems. Those have to be changed. Our parent information handbooks, we have to communicate with parents effectively during nighttime meetings. So the trickle-down effect is far and wide.
John?
Please, and Dr. Teitel, go ahead. Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, because we just went through, and I echo exactly what she's saying, we just went through a math curriculum revision for our district. We also found that most of the resources that we were currently using are not aligned to the Common Core, particularly at the middle school and the high school level. So we're looking at having to invest, you know, $500,000 or more in new resources to be aligned to the Common Core. Many of the publishers have not caught up with this yet, but there's going to be an expense across the whole state for districts to get new resources that align to the Common Core, and in some cases they're not fully developed yet because of the lag. So in addition to having to do all this work on curriculum assessment, progress reports, and so forth, you've got all these new resources that you need to get. And it's not that it isn't warranted. It's just, again, in these era of shrinking budgets and limited time, it's a concern.
So, Michelle, how do you make this happen in the classroom? What do you do?
Well, I'm not in the classroom, but my job is to help classroom teachers. So, you know, there's one way to eat an elephant, and it's one bite at a time. So we started with a study of the Common Core, and someone already mentioned that there are practices now. So not only does the content change, but how students should be interacting with mathematics also change. So once you change one part, you know, the content, you have to look at what the student is doing and you have to look at what the teacher is doing. So we're trying to hit it at every level, and it really is a focused and rigorous change that is welcomed. But the rush to do this by 2015 feels overreaching.
So it sounds to me like you're saying this in total is a good thing. What should be the timeline, Michelle? How much longer should it take to roll out? What do you need?
Well, I'm lucky. I'm working in a district that has a clear vision, and we've made a plan, and we have resources. So I feel like we're in good shape here with mathematics. But don't forget, these changes are coming in reading and writing, and in a couple of years, science. So I think here we have what we need. One of the biggest changes is for technology, so that children can take these online assessments, and that's a huge expenditure. And just getting small children, like third graders, ready to do that with fine motor skills and all the things that they need to do on the keyboard is another detail that we have to pay attention to. So it's everything, all the way from curriculum down to keyboarding, really.
David Teitel, before we let you go, in just a minute or so left here, with this perfect storm all happening at the same time, you and Michelle are saying the same thing, almost too much at once to be able to do. But are these changes welcome long term? Do you think that they provide the type of academic rigor that we need in Connecticut?
Well, I think some of them are. I think that, you know, we've had standards in Connecticut that have been very rigorous for a long time. Standards aren't new here, and occasionally standards need to be updated. But I think that the attempt to do this as rapidly as it's being done, largely driven by the need to get the waiver from the burden of No Child Left Behind, I think the high-stakes nature of the assessments that are coming out of this, I think, is very counterproductive. I think that's going to squeeze out even more non-tested areas than ever before. I think there's all of the faults of No Child Left Behind are going to get magnified as this thing rolls out, because people are going to respond to incentives. And if your evaluation in your school is being judged by performance on standardized tests more and more than ever before, you're going to get some unintended consequences of that, and I worry about it.
Dr. David Teitel, superintendent of the Fairfield Public Schools, thank you so much, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks also to Michelle Peterson, who's a math specialist with the Farmington Public Schools. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
We just have 30 seconds left, Diane Orson. Boy, what he's saying is, and we said this up front, if you didn't like the high-stakes testing from before, and we've talked a lot about this, it seems as though this is part of the new world.
Yeah, and I wonder about the rollout time for this. I wonder if we could just get a final comment on how...
I think, you know, when we talk about the assessments, we need to remember that the achievement has always been high stakes for kids, and that if they don't have the opportunity to learn high rigorous standards, it's their lives later that they don't have. And the new assessments are actually things we would want our kids to be able to do.
And these assessments, these high stakes assessments start when?
2015.
Dr. Diana Roberge-Wenzel is Chief Academic Officer of the State of Connecticut. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you to Diane Orson, WNPR's education reporter. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan, who produced today's program. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.